I'll introduce you.
Okay.
And then we'll just jump in. It's just setting up. It's just thinking. Okay, hang on. I have to introduce you. Hello, and welcome to At a Crossroads with the Naked Podcast. I'm your host, Jen Taylor. I'm so excited to be here. Doug, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you.
I love this conversation. You and I chatted less than 10 months ago, I think it was, and it was a month after your wife died. So I know we're going to go into that. First, I want to jump in on the websites. Well, first I want to say, like, I stalk you everywhere that I can. So there's that. And I have for a long time, and we're connected on Facebook, and I really, really love your posts, and I really appreciate them. So I want to start off with that, actually. How's that?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
The next thing I want to do is jump into, you have two websites. So one is the Talent C and the other one is International Mentoring Community. So let's jump in with who you are and what you're doing right now. We've done this before, but I really want to dive into that and how it's changed in the last 10 months. Because we talked, I guess we were a year into COVID and a month after your wife died. So things have changed a lot. So catch us up with everything. Tell us about the websites, about what you do, and bridge the gap for me.
So as far as the websites are concerned, we'll start with maybe the Talent C one first. And that's basically my own company per se. And I focus on working with individuals, mentoring, one-on-ones, group mentoring, all of that sort of stuff. And I've now branched into, I guess is the best word I can come up with, but is I've now gotten involved in the mental health space a lot more stringently than what I had when we talked last. So I'm involved in a couple support groups. I'm working with individuals myself, one-on-one. So I'm doing a lot of that. So that's kind of ties back to the Talent C1. And then with the International Mentoring Community, that's primarily focused on providing certification for mentors based on competence. So when we think back to most certifications that I know from my research, and that when it came to mentoring, we're focused on knowledge. So very knowledge-based and nothing on the practical application of how do I take that knowledge and apply that in an actual mentoring situation? So the International Mentoring Community answers that question by providing for the certification of mentors based on competence. So you have to be able to verify or provide through an audit process. You have to be able to verify that you can actually apply that knowledge that you need to have in order to be what I call an effective mentor.
I think this is true with everything. I do speaking, and in speaking, you know, I've gone to conferences and whether you are forced to do it through work or you're excited about doing it because you actually, it was one you wanted to sign up for. I want to get something out of it. I don't want to waste my time. And it's always been frustrating to me that, you know, you get to this conference, you set aside the time. Often you're like moving things around with your family and your home life because, you know, there are weekends or evenings or whatever. And they give you all the rah-rah, you're all excited, but then you leave and there's no way to apply it. And so I know in my speaking, my entire goal was, I'm going to give you what you want to do, the reason why you want to do it, and how is that's the biggest missing link. And that's just in like a 20 to 60 minute speaking thing. You're talking about mentoring. So dive in a little bit deeper for me about what you feel like is missing. I mean, I know the practical application, but how does that go off the rails?
It comes back to being able to provide what I call a deeper, richer mentoring experience. And the only way that that's achievable, I mean, you can take in and do all the learning that you want as much as you possibly can. But if you can't take that learning and actually physically apply that in a mentoring situation. So, you know, a real good example is you're working with somebody who is struggling with mental health, and you decide that you're going to have a conversation with them, but they jump the gun on you and they go into what I call a rant to sort of clear everything that's sort of sitting, you know, sitting on their shoulders or that's locked in their gut, so to speak. And what would you do in a situation? You know, do you follow the textbook? And the textbook says, well, you interject and try and get to the root cause. Well, in a practical application of that, I take that knowledge, but I turn around and I change how we're going to approach that by letting the person have their 15 to 20 minute rant. Because what will happen is if I try to interject, it's like pouring gas on an open fire. So they don't want to hear what you have to say. They don't want your wisdom, knowledge, whatever you want to call it. They don't want any of that. They just want someone to listen and hear what they have to say, someone who's non-judgmental. That's not in the textbook.
Isn't this is the same lesson that we need in marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know my husband and I are so different, and I talk to process. Like, I actually just need to verbally vomit things out just to figure out what I'm like, where am I even at with this? It's not to fix it. It's just to organize my thoughts or categorize my thoughts. And where he's the opposite, you know, when he talks, he's ready to get something done. But still, because I like to fix things, I have to ask him, is this something you just want to discuss with me? Or is this something that you want me to offer suggestions? Right. And you're talking about the exact same thing. The other thing is I don't ever try to fix it. Even with my kids, it's a parenting thing. It's a marriage thing. It's a coworker thing, is that if you say, do you mind if I offer a suggestion? People almost always say, no, yeah, that'd be great. Offer a suggestion. Or could I share my opinion or my thoughts with you? That is so non-confrontational. When people are spilling their guts in this way, there's a lot of fear behind what the person on the other end, how they're going to respond to them. And so I always like just saying, can I offer a suggestion? Because you don't have to take my suggestion. And
There's another approach, and it involves the Socratic method, right? And that's simply by saying, what would happen if we, so you and I together, what would happen if we were to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And so not non-confrontational, right? And it gets the other person thinking. And when you use the word we and us, it's a collaborative approach. And in marriage, that's what we strive for, is collaboration, right? The compromise. And so it's a matter of just how you frame that or word that can sort of change, will change the outcome of what comes out of that conversation.
I love posing one, if you pose things so that you, the person is becoming curious about themselves, you know, it's just shifting the lens that you're viewing the whatever the issue or problem or struggle is, well, let's be curious about that. And I love the other thing about saying that we are us. That's awesome. I love that. Cause you're right, in marriage, that's absolutely true. I really like that. But the reframing and rephrasing is really super important. Can you share with me, what is the difference between mentoring and coaching? I inadvertently opened a can of worms. Awesome.
Well, sort of. It's the $64,000 question. What is the difference between the two? And you can go online and you can search on both pose that question, and you're going to get a number of very different answers. For me, what the difference that I always seem to see, and I get brought in sometimes when coaching is, and we'll get to the definition of that in a minute, but when coaching hasn't worked. And so then they'll say, well, Doug, can you come in and do whatever it is you do so that, you know, we can get this employee back on track? So in my viewpoint of coaching is very, very structured, very driven by performance-related issues. where mentoring is more so about the mentee, the employee, using this as an example, the employee is driving, sort of driving the bus is how I describe it. So they're the ones that determine the agenda, and I'm the guide. I'm going to ask questions to guide that employee to the answers they need to have in order to get back on track again.
There's something on your website that you said that you, there are lots of mentoring organizations that offered services, including certification, but no independent body that would oversee the certification. I think it's, you have a very different way of looking at things. So take me through that process, because you went through that process yourself to document it, is my understanding, so that you could be able to certify mentors.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. So what was that like to go through, and how much did you have to go through in order to come up with an outline of what that looks like?
So I've been down that path twice. Mm-hmm. Two different business partners to get there. And the first one was very much knowledge-based, knowledge-driven. So it was a matter of, to get certified, you had to pass a couple exams.
Right.
And there was a little bit of the practical application where you had to put a bit of a portfolio together, but nothing of any major consequence. It was pass those exams and you've just hit a home run, you're good to go. What was missing, though, is that, and that's where there was the gap with when I did all my research and I looked at all the other organizations that provide mentor certification, as they called it, and the independent body. What was missing was there was nothing that said that if I put all this stuff together and I do all these things and I take the knowledge and I apply that in a practical sense, there was nothing that said, where do I go from there? And that's when I found a business partner in Alberta, that what we ended up doing was we had conversations back and forth. And where we landed was we were both saying the same thing, was that there needed to be a certification for mentors based on competence. And so how that happened was we wrote, I'll use our term, which is action outcome statements, but it's like a competence profile, you know, where you knowledge, skill, and ability, and all those sorts of things. But it was a competence based action outcome. So there would be, for the certificate of competence mentor, there is about 72. Action outcome statements that you have to be able to demonstrate that you have the knowledge, but that you can actually apply that knowledge in those particular situations. And so, and there's much the same, the certificate of competence journey mentor, which gets you into the mental health space. There's some additional action outcome statements there that you need to be able to address in the process. So the process involves a mentoring log, and then you have to go through and do a number of, you build your profile. So it'll be answering, I think there's three case studies that you'll go through, and you'll put all that stuff together. And here's the kicker, that's really the important part, is you then take all that information and you appear before a verification panel for about, I was 2.5 hours. And you go through and you provide them examples, real life lived experiences of how you've taken the knowledge and the stuff that's in the action outcome and how you've actually applied that in real life situations. And if you can do that and do that well, then you become certified competent as a mentor. And then every 2 years, you have to go through a recertification process.
So where coaching has no regulations at all. And I became a coach, and that really bothered me. And it was really important for me to get not a certification, but a training that actually equated to the same thing you're saying, actual use as a coach in real life situations. It was super important for me, but coaching has no regulation. So this is actually awesome. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about bringing mentoring to mental health. And if this is the time that we jump back into your story a bit, that's awesome, because you've definitely had your journey that I'm sure, I mean, all entrepreneurs, their goal is to make it faster, easier, and more supported for other people. And we are our own avatar. I hate when programs are like, you know, design your avatar. My avatar is me 17 years ago. I don't know, like, you know, I mean, like, I'm speaking to that one. It's me. And so I don't need to create this whole avatar. I know exactly who the person is I'm speaking to. And I'm sure in a lot of respects, that was very similar to in your case. But I want to talk about switching gears and applying mentoring specifically to mental health. That is the most fascinating part of what you do to me. And I know your background, so share it in whatever way you want.
So I'll just give a quick, for the benefit of our listeners, is that retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police, served for 25 years. Yes. As a result of my service, I ended up with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Didn't know that that's what it was that I had. And until I started to do my research for my second book that is due to be released here very soon. We'll probably come back to that one in due course. But the big thing that I came to realize was that as a result of now starting to understand post-traumatic stress and understanding that I was a first-class asshole, pardon my language, but I was just a jerk with my dear sweet wife and with my two children and with my inner circle of friends, which got, strangely enough, kept getting smaller and smaller. And I couldn't figure out why. And it was because of, you know, the behavior. I turned to alcohol as a mask to be able to cover, or I thought it was, geez, just drink a bottle of scotch, Doug, and all your problems will go away. Well, no, they got worse. Oh, really? What are you going to do about that? Oh, I'll probably have another drink. You know, so it ended up, fast forward, I retire from the RCMP and didn't get any support from the organization. So there was no support structure in place. So Deborah, my good wife, and my two kids, Matthew and Brandy, they were the ones that stepped to the plate and said, okay, inside that body, that shell, there's really the true Doug that we all know, or Dad, or my husband. And we got to help get him out of that shell. And so they did that. They supported me, somewhat not willingly, as I found out. I was speaking at a conference in Winnipeg. I was actually teaching. I think I was teaching a one-day workshop. And it was, somebody had asked a question, and my wife, who I brought along with me, Deborah, I brought her along. She said, well, let me answer that one. He doesn't know how lucky he is that we're still with him, because we came very close to walking. And it was because of his...
surprise on stage.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. It was like, because of your what?
It was because of my bad behavior, my drinking, you know, just not being a nice person whatsoever. And that's what, you know, all of a sudden you get dropped with that bombshell and I go, oh, excuse me, how am I going to deal with that one? And, you know, so I ended up, we had the conversation. Good thing it's a 6-hour drive, because we had the conversation in the car on the way home was, you know, did you actually mean that? And she went, uh-huh, yeah. So lots of things that, you know, have come to fruition as a result of my time in the force and starting to write the book and realizing, oh my gosh, now I know why people thought I was a jerk. And it's because, you know, post-traumatic stress and all of that. And I've kind of gone through a reflection where I was wondering why you would think that if you moved from one spot to the next, that everything would be okay, because you'd be starting over. But what ended up happening was that every time we moved, something similar would happen. So if I got transferred from, let's say, Hay River to Cambridge Bay in the high Arctic, and I dealt with something in Hay River, and it reappeared again in Cambridge Bay, it was like a trigger. It was a massive trigger. And all of a sudden my bad behavior came back and my resorting back, well, let's see if we drink more than what we drank last time, maybe that'll fix the problem. And it was going through all of that. And there, those triggers just kept bringing me back to where I did want to go.
It's so hard when you're in any situation, no matter what, I think, to see the common denominators. You know, I have some of my younger adult kids who are like, you know, all of my friends are like this. And this happens every time I get really close with a friend. And, you know, you're the common denominator, whether it's the people that you're choosing or attracting, or it's your attitude. But like, if the same things continue to play over and over again in new situations with different people, you are the common denominator. And that's a really hard one to admit and talk about and be curious about, because nobody wants to be the common denominator that's bad. You know, how did your family, your wife and your kids were all on board and then were helping you come out of your shell? What things did they do to help facilitate that?
A large part of it was, and no disrespect intended to any of my family members, but they kept, my dad was an alcoholic, and what they basically said is, go look in the mirror and do you like the person you see? Does it look like your dad? And if you think it does, then I think maybe we collectively need to figure something out how we can change that.
That would be one of the worst things you could say to me. So, yeah. Now, let's jump into books, because you're getting ready to release your second book. So jump in on that.
So that's, the book is entitled You Are Not Alone. I just love that title. You Are Not Alone. And when you get to see, so you're going to have to, people are going to have to buy the book just to see the book cover, because it is absolutely, it blows your mind when you get a chance to see it. You can get a sneak peek of what it's going to be like if you go onto the Amazon website, and the pre-order site is it's up. It's available to pre-order the book, which will come out on the 17th of January. So there's the marketing piece. I wrote the book. I was asked to write another book. So when I wrote my first one, The Gift of Mentoring, I had three or four people come to me and say, you need to write a book on mentoring, because all the books that are out are all academically focused, and there's nothing that is the practical application of that. So I did that. And then lo and behold, you know, COVID starts to come and all this stuff, and people are saying, you know, a lot of what it is that you do would be of great value in the mental health space. Why don't you write a book about that? And so I go, yeah, okay. So that's where the drive, the motivation to write You Are Not Alone came from, that particular spot. And the book is, I tell a lot about my own personal story, but I also interviewed, I think it was 5 different individuals who each one had a specific story that we were looking for. And we've included that in the book as well. But I kind of bare my soul in the book, where I don't pull any punches. And I kind of like what we're talking about here right now. I make no bones about the fact that I was a jerk. And if it wasn't for Deborah and, you know, Brandy and Matthew, I may not be here today. In fact, I know I probably wouldn't be.
Tell me about that transformation for you. Did you work in mental health with mentoring prior to realizing you were a jerk? I'm just going to use your own words. I'm not. I've never seen that side of you. I'm just taking your word for it. So
yeah, the new Doug is definitely, that's the better one to have.
2.0.
Yeah.
So were you working in the mental health space as a mentor prior to realizing your own PTSD and your own?
No.
Okay. I'm trying to get the connection when you started working with people with mental health in the mentoring, because I find that part fascinating. So I know other people probably, I mean, corporate, yes, it makes sense, and to get people on track, and that's a really great thing to do. But in the mental health space, especially with PTSD, that's so niche down and so specific and really tough stuff. So what was it like when you were being asked for that? Were people seeing your transformation personally and asking you to work in that space? Were you drawn to it because of your own experience?
It was, I started out with a mentoring relationship, and it evolved from that to a mentoring relationship with a focus on mental health. So I ended up, and I started to see, And I guess I have to be somewhat, I don't know what word I would use, but I feel as though I've been given a gift, because I can usually, by simply having a conversation and sort of looking at a person, and as I call it, I kind of scan them as an individual, I can usually sense or tell when something's not right. And when that happens, then I start to ask the questions without becoming overbearing or judgmental or anything like that. It's, I'm getting a sense that you're struggling with some things, or I'm getting a sense that you don't believe in who you are as a person. And if that's the case, then how are we, if I'm to mentor you in the business world, how can I mentor you and help you market and sell what it is you have to sell when you don't believe in what it is or in your ability as well? And then we start to uncover that, and we talk about, you know, going through the self-esteem, self-confidence makeover. But as we're going through and starting to do that, what we're also starting to recognize is there's some not so nice things here that we need to have a conversation about. There's been some trauma that's taken place during the childhood and so on, right? So, and it's just, it's getting, because I've sort of kicked the can over and it's all spilled out on the road now, that seems to be what happens more and more and more often is, and I think it's because I'm more acutely aware of that. And so I go for that right away, because I know that I may as well go there and not waste that person's time by sort of dancing around the bush a bit. Let's just get right to, you know, the facts and help me understand why you feel the way you do.
I love that. And so that's a more intuitive thing. And also with the knowledge, like you touched on, like all of us have been through traumas. We've all, like, I know we'll get into this in a minute, like I get asked about grief a lot, and grief and loss, it doesn't have to be a death. It can be a job. It can be a lot of things. And that can be a trauma. A car accident can create PTSD. You know, you don't have to check certain boxes to have these feelings or have that considered a loss or have that be a trauma. And I do the same thing. I go there immediately, because almost 100% of the time, there's something that happened in that person's past. In first grade, you know, Tommy on the playground, or the teacher that told you you stunk at a test, or an abuse in the past that, like, and I just yesterday, I said, often something that we're feeling in our present is actually the same feeling we felt over and over and over again from a time that we may not even remember in our past, like as long as we can remember. And it often exhibits itself in low self-esteem or lack of self-worth or feelings of failure. And you can say that to 100 people and every one of them is going to respond probably with like, yes, because we've all been through something. Every one of us has been through something, right? So I love that. I love that you go in for that right away. And you cannot, in your brain, your conscious and unconscious mind, can't separate out. No, this is the business Doug now. So the personal Doug's not going to have any bearing on how I react, right? We can't. I love your mentoring program. And I I have, you know, like I said, I've been stalking you. I love your mentoring program. And I love that you're hitting on mental health because it does cross so many boundaries. Are people showing up more specifically, like, is the first thing that they're showing up for in mental health as opposed to corporate, or corporate saying, I really want to work on mental health? Are they marrying more? No, no. Not as interesting. What a shame.
We still have, well, here's the one thing I see is that is if the organization comes forward and says that, okay, we want you to help us implement mentoring in our organization. Okay, so checkbox number one, tick that one. That's good. That's good, you know, for the employees and everything else. But what needs to be built into that mentoring program, if you don't have it already, is the mental health support structure.
Yeah.
So let's kill, poor choice of words, but let's kill two birds with one stone. Let's come in and let's implement mentoring, but let's implement it from the aspect of, yes, we're going to have this where we, what's my definition? It's a two-way trusted relationship where both the mentor and mentee are going to learn and grow personally and professionally together. So there's that part. But now let's plug in the mental health spot where our organization recognizes mental health as something that we need to work on. And as a result of that, we want to put the support structure in place so that our employees actually will have a place to go or people they can go and talk to be able to have those conversations.
There have been studies that have come out. So tell me if you have any of these, or you work with any of these, about mental health in the workplace. And that includes the environment of the workplace. There have been some that I've read that are like the chair you sit on, where, you know, you can sit on a yoga ball instead of a chair, or having plants in the environment, or companies that allow you to bring your dog in with you. I mean, like, there's so many of them that I've read over the years, but basically the same thing is that when you create an environment that fosters mental health, you get much better workers.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's why I work from home, and I have for 5.5 years, because for me, I am much more driven when I can switch my laundry and eat when I want to and batch my work, and I don't have distractions. We all work differently, but, you know, I can set up my environment so that I am the best version of myself coming forward. So I love the mental health aspect because you can go in so many different directions. Yeah. And create an atmosphere that really, it's the same with maternity leave or paternity leave and being able to have more time. In the US, we get like 6 weeks, and other countries, they get a year. That's like that. And paternity gets the same. That's incredible to me. I can't even wrap my mind around having had a year after a baby was born to get back on track and get paid and work from home and have my work-life balance look like that. That's phenomenal. So let's talk about now. Let's switch it up. like we talked about on the last episode, your wife had died, and I could not believe when I went back and looked in the episode, because when we first talked and I was getting ready for this episode, I was like, oh, we spoke before your wife passed away. And we didn't. You talked to me a month after your wife passed away, which I am so grateful for your willingness to be that raw. And when I went back and looked at it, I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. Now you've had 9 or 10 months since then, but we've also been 9 or 10 months in a pandemic, and your wife happened to die in the pandemic as well. Cause we're now we're over a year and a half in. So we're talking, and your business has gotten to continue to change. So can we talk about all of those things in whatever order you want to? Okay. Just jump in.
So the first thing is I wanted to thank you, because you were the first person that I opened up to publicly about her passing. So thank you for doing that. It made, you were able to help me get comfortable with talking about that. And the more I talked about it, the better I felt, but I was starting to be able to get to a place where each month that went by, things start to fall into place a little bit easier than perhaps what they normally would. So And it's been, it was actually 10 months yesterday that if you go by the, it was the 6th of February. So it was the 6th of, it was yesterday, 6th of December that, you know, she had passed away. And I try my very best, my hardest to, I never said I said that I would never post on Facebook. I would never put pictures. Well, bad me. I broke that rule probably 2-3 months ago. And because I want to honor her memory, and I don't want it to get lost. And she had an impact on a lot of people. We did a celebration of life in August, and we held it at the hotel that she worked at, and we had over 90 people showed up for that. And, you know, my two children did an admirable job of putting together a story that they told. We all told stories. Anyone that was asked to speak was given the parameters around, you know, what we want you to do is tell your story, the memories and that, you know, seem to stick with you. And that's what we did. I even shared the story of the photo album bride, which was Deborah was the, I was good friends when I was stationed in the RCMP in Northern British Columbia. I was good friends with her aunt and uncle, and she ended up, her folks thought it was better for her to go and stay with her aunt and uncle and get her away from all the male distractions that she was experiencing at home, only to realize that she ended up getting engaged to me as a result of that. But how that came to be was one night over a few drinks with her aunt and uncle, and they brought out the family photo album and started flipping through, and there was this picture of Deborah, and I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "That's our niece." I said, "Get her up here now." And that was the start of it, of her and I going back and forth with that tumultuous relationship, and eventually resulting in a short time later of her, of us getting engaged and eventually getting married and stuff. So it was, so I shared that story with, you know, with the people in attendance. And I'm not sure if, I think most of them got the sort of the humorous side of it, but I don't know. I think for some, it was why is he telling us that? But anyhow, I went through and did that. What's happened for me is I hate weekends, and I hate weekends with a passion, because that was always our time together where we ran errands and did all sorts of thought. You know, we went and saw the grandkids, we did all that. And what's interesting is I thought I'm the only person that is impacting them, but I belong to a bereavement counseling group, and in the small group that I'm in, I think that was the one I started it. The one day I said, "I just hate weekends. I'm sorry, but I hate them." And two other people said, "Yeah, that's ditto for us. I hate weekends with a passion." And it's just because of that, is that, you know, you don't, the things you were doing in the past, you don't do now because something's missing.
I want to share something with you, actually, and I want to get a date before I think I know the date, but I just want to make sure that I'm correct. Okay, September. So we our first interview, when you talked about your wife dying, and it was to give everybody reference, it was March 3rd, so it was just under a month after your wife had passed away. So that was March of 2021. August 2016, my 23-year-old son was listed as a missing person. And 4 years later, in August 2020, they matched his remains to his DNA. So that was August of 2020. And we spoke March of 2021. So 7 months after we found out that they had matched. Now, in 4 years of a missing person, you assume that they are deceased and you're waiting for them to match the remains. And having said that, you don't realize how much hope you're holding out for until it's gone. and you have this 4 years of limbo. Well, for me, it was 4 years of limbo. And then you finally get the answer and it's, you're angry because it's not the answer you wanted. Cause you, there was this glimmer of hope. Like one day he's going to walk through and be like, Mom, I'm totally sorry. I signed up for the circus and like 4 years went by. I didn't even realize, right? Like we realistically, that's not going to happen, but you are. And so you spoke 7 months later, a month after your wife, I wrote about my son's death for the first time this September, 2021. So I waited 13 months after they found the remains to even start. And it wasn't that I didn't talk about it, but to actually come out in public. And I can't even tell you, before that, people came to me a lot for grief. So I must project something about that. And it was not my first death. It was my most difficult, but it certainly wasn't my first, the first death to someone close to that I had experienced. And when I wrote it, and then I did a video about it, and I've been more for it. It's like your inbox explodes, sort of, you know? And so I understand what you're saying, where like you just started coming out and actually talking about it. And I think that that's cathartic for us and therapeutic for us. And what I would have to say with having a death of someone that close, like you and I have experienced, is that it doesn't get easier and you don't miss them less, but you don't cry every day because you've learned to live with the loss and move forward with the loss instead of like, I'm never going to not miss him or be, that's never going to happen. I'm never going to not be sad that that person's gone. And he's not the first person I felt that way about. My stepmother was another one that was really hard for me. So, you know, you helped me through that process too, because I was 7 months in quiet when we spoke then. And since then, even though it took me a few more months to get there, but since then I started coming forward about it. And it's one of those things that should be really openly talked about a lot more, I think. I don't know if there's a stigma behind it, or like me and you, the people that are talking about it, are afraid it's going to be morbid. And it actually helps a lot to not feel sad and upset. Like by you saying, I hate weekends, right? You're just owning it. You're not wallowing in that. You're actually working through some of that. And so right back at you, I want to thank you too. So you didn't even know.
No,
surprise,
I didn't.
Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you coming forward, I think, is huge, and having the memorial. We haven't done a memorial yet. His remains are still 7 hours away. And we're trying to figure out how to do that. You know, the whole family, we just kind of are trying to figure it all out. And those are some tough things that you don't know you're going to have to face until you face them. And you don't know how you're going to handle until you have those shoes on. So how did losing your wife and your PTSD, were there parallels in that? You'd worked through the PTSD so much by the time you lost her, but were there triggers or similarities?
Well, what was also concerning, and I was trying to be, well, I guess I am now trying to sort of say, what would have happened had Deborah still been alive, and I would have been totally immersed in the mental health mentoring and all of that. Because what I find is that if you don't have a mechanism in place to unload all of that negative energy, it just keeps pushing you down and down and down. And then you start to, the triggers, the little triggers that you were able to manage before now become bigger triggers. And so I'm conscious and mindful all the time of, okay, so if you had that, you know, gee, if I just had maybe just one drink, and I don't want to lose the ground that I've gained so far by saying, well, that's the easy way to deal with that situation is to do that. So, but that's the biggest thing that I think would, if Deborah was still here physically, I think that what would end up happening is, just because of, you know, the how we communicated with each other, we'd be having more and more of those conversations. And that when I would say, you know, this, without giving out any confidential information. And sometimes I did anyhow, because if I can't trust her, who could I trust? So, but it was, you know, I don't know if I could do this much more. And then it was, but you have to, because there's no one else. And, you know, we'll support you and we'll help you get through this, but you have to continue to do this. And I went through a past life regression with a hypnotherapist. And I think I spoke about that probably last time. And where what came out of that was, in two or three of the lives that we relived, I was a healer. And, and basically the story was that, you know, you have all these different experiences over the course of all these decades and centuries. And now is the time when you've been asked to take and apply those and to help people on their healing journey as well. So I think there would have been some parallels, as to use, you know, to use your term. There, had Deborah still been here today, we would be dealing with those parallels. And what does that mean to us as a family? And how are we going to deal with some of that?
Tell me about your relation with Deborah, and how much, when things were getting better for you and you were recognizing the issues and not being so much of a jerk. I've never been able to just sit and call someone a jerk before. It's kind of fun.
You like that, don't you?
There's a little part of me that kind of likes it. But when your behavior was getting better, when the alcohol, first of all, you had to give up alcohol. Let's talk about that. And then you had to start recognizing and owning your behaviors, and that mirror, the mirror is the scariest place to be, mm-hmm. you know? And then I want to talk about how much your relationships changed with Deborah and the kids. And I mean, that's astronomical.
It will be 2 years in March since I've had a drink.
Yay, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Part of it's health reasons, and part of it was the realization that if I didn't change that, I was going to lose the most valuable thing in my life, and that was Deborah.
Yeah.
And that happened anyhow, but I still have, you know, I've still got two grown children that I need to be there for. They're not children, they're adults now, and a couple grandkids that, you know, I don't want to be that person that nobody wants to be around. I don't want to be that person anymore. And, you know, I'm almost 99.99% sure I'll never have a drink again. I what's it going to gain me? Probably nothing at this juncture. It's probably not I can have just as much fun with the non-alcoholic stuff as I can if I was drinking, you know, Scotch whiskey or whatever, right? So don't need it.
Yeah. And when you realize, I mean, your relationships have to be so much more rich without it. Yeah. I think when you see that, when you have that stark realization, the comparison.
Yeah, you don't realize how those decisions that I made in my younger years, where I thought I'll just drink a bottle of scotch and everything will go away and everything will be better, and it never did. It never got better. It only got worse.
Yeah,
and it was when, you know, I think I started to sort of scale back prior to the 2 year time frame where I've gone completely dry. I started to scale back where, you know, maybe it was one or two drinks on a weekend or something like that. But I actually enjoy getting up in the morning and it not being fuzzy.
Who knew? Yeah. I mean, it's huge, huh? Especially the older we get, the harder it is to bounce back from anything. So, I mean, alcohol definitely responds differently. My 20-year-old daughter and my 30-year-old daughter, totally different conversations about alcohol with the two of them, because it's, they've just gotten 10 years older and wiser and their bodies respond differently. Yeah. So yeah, I completely understand that. Let's talk about Deborah. You reconciled your marriage and your relationship prior to her death.
Correct.
Which is pretty amazing. And take us through that. She died of cancer, correct?
Yeah.
So you knew about it to some degree.
Yeah. I think it was back in October, I guess it would be.
Yeah.
When she was experiencing back pain mostly back pain, I guess, lower back pain. And we were trying all sorts of different modalities, acupuncture, massage therapy, all of the different ones, and nothing seemed to really be working. And it was, excuse me, her family doctor said to her, I think it was the 7th of December, that you need to go to emergency and get this checked out. And we did. And other than a brief stay at home where we brought in a bed from Palliative Care and got right next to where I'm sitting was the area that we had it set up as kind of her space. And I was there, she could keep an eye on me and make sure I was working and stuff too, which was kind of interesting, but in any event. So it was from December 7th until February 6th. I think she was home. We actually had this conversation here the last couple days, but I think it was about 2 weeks. And then she had chemotherapy done. And I swear, even to this day, that was not a good decision, because she had chemotherapy and within a week it was gone. The chemo just killed her immune system, something fierce. It would have been a week, because she had chemo on a Friday. She had to wear a bottle with chemo with the drugs in it, and it would do a steady drip all weekend long. We took her back on Monday to have it removed. And within that week, I think she was on the downhill slide. So, but yeah, we had lots of conversations, and even to this day, I still think I would like to have, if I could buy back some time, that I would, there's more that we needed to talk about. We just didn't get the chance. And COVID wasn't our best friend either, because there was times where I wasn't allowed to even be in the room or even on the floor for that matter, where she was. And we spent Christmas apart. I went and ordered from one of her favorite chefs in the city, ordered a meal, and I delivered it to the hospital. And I actually got special permission to take it from the lobby upstairs to her floor, and then had the nurses hand deliver it. And then I had ordered one for myself, and I took it home, and then we powered up FaceTime, and we had Christmas dinner together.
Oh. How much has the business changed in COVID? Because I'm sure we touched up on this before, but I didn't think we'd still be having this conversation. So how much has there been a shift in that?
I think that organizations are still struggling with the recovery process as far as getting back on track. And because I think we're now back to where before we may have had an abundance of employees or workers or people looking for work. I think it's flipped a bit, where now organizations are scrambling to try and find resources to even help them as part of that. Like I think of the hospitality industry is really scrambling to find people to come and work in the hotels and those industries, right? And there's, I think there's still a concern. Is that a safe place for me to go back to? You know, I will go to a coffee shop and have a cup of coffee and sit there and have that. But I'm just trying to think if I don't think I've been to a restaurant for a meal. I've ordered pickup and done all that sort of stuff, but to be honest, I can't recall having gone to a restaurant and sitting down and eating in a couple of years.
It's definitely changed a lot. I think, you know, people are moving online. I think there were some really great things. The ability to work from home it's a double-edged sword, but it's really great in a lot of ways. Realizing that you don't need as much and reducing overhead was a great thing for companies. Really looking at I know there's a lot of talk about essential workers, and my husband was an essential worker. And in every company, though, you can really look at who's actually the most essential person and trimming the fat and then looking for the people that are the best fit. And so it's been an interesting shift. The mental health side of it is probably, I mean, I don't know, you'd have to tell me, but in my mind, I would think that because of this, we're all feeling a great amount of loss. It doesn't matter how you feel politically or about any of the issues. We've still lost a lot of our control and freedom and the way we used to live, no matter how you feel about the situation. Mm-hmm. And people are really struggling with that. It changed childcare for people. It's absolutely huge how much it shifted. So I would think that if companies are asking for mentorship, that mental health aspect of it is much bigger or more recognized. Maybe it's not bigger, but we recognize it more now because of this situation. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I know that when I go to implement a mentoring program, if somebody company comes and says, can you implement a program, help us implement a program, I automatically build in the mental health space. Sorry, but I've got your undivided attention. I'm going to drive home this point that if we don't do this, your employees will walk and they'll go someplace else where there is a mental health support system in place. Because it impacts productivity. It impacts their mental well-being as an individual. There's just so many different things that it touches on that if we don't spend the time. A good example, and this one just always keeps coming back to me, is in one of the police forces that I have a couple colleagues that are there. And one of the things that we talked about is when you have someone in the police force that is off sick with post-traumatic stress, so they've been, you know, medical leave and whatsoever, when they go to come back and get back into the workforce, what is it that you do to help them assimilate back into the workforce?
Yeah.
And the answer is nothing. And so what we've been saying all along is that have a mentor that can work with that employee, that police officer, to help them transition back into the workforce, so that you don't just kind of say, oh, you had post-traumatic stress and they've doctors signed you back on duty and that. Boom, push you out into the deep end of the pool and away you go, figure it out, swim, sink or swim. No, that's not how you deal with those things.
Yeah. I've definitely seen a much higher level of compassion, I think, or understanding. I feel like companies now need to look at things in a much different way than they used to. That's kind of they can't be as flip. I mean, I think before, one of the biggest things are like sexual harassment suits or Even if any kind of harassment suit was probably one of the biggest thing. And a complaint is workers that waste a lot of time. And, you know, those issues are just not the same at all now. Not that they've gone away completely, but they've definitely shifted. And I also think that employees' tolerance is a lot lower for being mistreated. And so I know that's a little bit of what I've seen out there.
The whole bullying piece is right, and we don't realize it, but that's also a cause for post-traumatic stress as well. Is, and I had a couple of places that I was where my boss was a bully, and it was verbal abuse, and as a result of that, that also adds another trigger that can be generated. If you go from place to place and you encounter the same sort of behavior, and I did in that case, I had it when I was in the RCMP, where, you know, the person I worked for was a bully, and then I got into private sector slash some more on the government side, and I worked for a person that same sort of thing, was very much a bully.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. I want to bring things back, and I like to end on a positive note. Start on a happy note and end on a happy note. I think we've had lots of happy notes within this time together. On your website, so who is your ideal client and the best way to reach out to you to work with you? Or I know your freebie was like a strategy session or a contact through the contact form.
Yeah. And that still applies, is, and even more so now because of the whole mental health piece and everything else, is just reach out on the contact, or they can send me a message directly through my email, which is, and I'll give that to you right now, which is doug.lawrence, L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E, at talentc. So the word talent with the letter C on the end, .ca. And like we had talked about when we originally had the first conversation, was that everything that I do is confidential. So, you know, if you send me an email, it's going to be treated with the utmost of confidentiality. Whether you use the contact page on the website on www.talentc.ca, or whether you do it through the email system, either or. And I will respond back as quickly as I possibly can. And, you know, if you just, one of the things that we're doing with this bereavement group that I'm part of is that what we've set up is, I think it's once every 2 or 3 weeks, we use a Zoom call, and anyone that wants to jump on, and if it's just to jump on and sort of talk and kind of say, you know, this is how I'm feeling, this is what's been going on, I'm not sure how to deal with it. Is anyone else experiencing the same thing? And if so, how are you dealing with it? And all of those things. We can do the same thing on a one-on-one as well. But that by all means, that's my gift back to our listeners, is please take advantage of that. And I know there's a stigmatism around mental health. Just ignore that. That's hocus pocus, nothing to it. You need to know that you have to do what's right for you. And you need to be able to say, okay, I need to reach out and speak to Doug, or I need to reach out and speak to, you know, to somebody else to be able to, so I got somebody I can talk to.
Well, and if they had a stigma before, I feel like you've been so open about how you feel about things and about who you've been and who you are, that they certainly shouldn't have a stigma with you. I'll make sure that I get I think your email is in the show notes, but I'll double check that. And also the book links, I'll add the book links to that also. Doug, thank you so much. I have so enjoyed talking with you again.
Yeah, me too. We do, you know, it's just a match made in heaven. How do you like that?